Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is in the matter of Griffin Trading Company. Ms. Steed.
May it please the Court. This is a simple case that has been made unnecessarily complicated. As originally tried, the issue before the bankruptcy court was whether defendants, two experienced commodity brokers, knew about a wire transfer in time to stop it. Defendants, who were sufficiently sophisticated about banking matters that their companies had multiple banks and transferred those funds overnight between their multiple bank accounts at multiple banks to earn a higher rate of return, testified that they would and could have stopped the wire transfer, but that they did not do so because they did not know about it. The bankruptcy court did not believe them. It found that they knew, and it found that they breached their duties to Griffin's customers when it took their money and used it to pay Griffin Company's liabilities.
So isn't one of the problems in this case, though, at least that concerned first Judge Phillip and then later judges who looked at this, the fact that there's no evidence of the exact wording or terms of the transfer orders? I mean, banks, of course, don't want to become liable to further banks down the chain because, similarly to letters of credit, you know, that's somebody else's problem.
And that was an error of law, and that was a misunderstanding of Article 4A. The evidence in the record showed exactly what Griffin Trading instructed its bank to do. Griffin Trading instructed its bank, when it received a margin call, Plaintiff's Exhibit 8, to pay 5 million Deutschmark the next day on December 23, 1998. Finbar O'Connor, who was the English liquidator, which was their version of the Chapter 7 trustee who handled the liquidation in London, testified in his affidavit that he had conducted an investigation of these transactions. Defendants offered that into evidence. He testified that this margin call was received that morning, that Stephen Rose of Griffin's London office contacted Bank of Montreal. Farrell Griffin, in his deposition testimony, which was admitted into evidence, gave the same testimony that Stephen Rose did this, and they instructed that the funds be transferred to Mies Pearson the next day.
Right, and so I guess working backwards, there's no reason to think that Mies Pearson would have agreed to stop this process. They wanted their money. So I guess what I am not clear about is whether the transfer order, in a sense, ordered in advance all of these steps. The way I have it charted, we've got London Clearinghouse to Bank of Montreal to Crédit Lyonnais Russe to back to Bank of Montreal, and then Bank of Montreal to Commerzbank. And if this was all scripted in advance, such that each bank had an expectation that its predecessor bank, you know, all these various other intermediary banks would act, then the ball's in Commerzbank's court, and their client, Mies Pearson, isn't going to stop it.
And, Your Honor, that could not have been the instruction. And the reason why it could not have been the instruction is that the payment order was to pay the next day, December 23rd. And as the law review article that they cite in their brief provides, as the treatise provides, under Section 4209B of Article 4D of Article 4A, the risk of an early transmission when you're given a particular payment date is on the bank. The bank could not have instructed payment before December 23rd because the evidence is that they were told to pay on December 23rd. So Bank of Montreal would have run liability to Griffin Trading had it instructed and paid prior to December 23rd. And we know the evidence from the second trial proves conclusively that Commerce Bank did not accept until 11:52 a.m. on December 23rd. It could not have accepted under Section 4209 of Article 4A, and therefore, since it could not accept before that time, Griffin had the right to cancel under Section 211. And why do we know that that's the case? We know there's three ways that a beneficiary bank, which is what Commerce Bank was, could accept. The three ways are it can pay the funds into the account of its beneficiary, Mies Pearson, or it can give Mies Pearson credit for those monies, even if it technically hasn't yet received the funds. It can give it notice that it's okay to go ahead and use this money. The testimony of Mr. Hoffman, the managing director of Mies Pearson, was that that did not happen. They were not given advance credit. That was not anything that was ever done in the industry or in connection with their banking relationship with Commerce Bank, and the funds were not paid into that account. We have the banking records of Ms. Pearson from Commerce Bank that show exactly when their account was credited.
But I guess I'm still concerned, or at least Judge Castillo and the others were concerned, about when rights became irrevocable for this chain of transfers to take place.
And they did not become irrevocable until 11:52 a.m. on December 23rd.
Aren't you arguing inferences that weren't drawn by the trier fact?
Well, they misunderstood the significance of what these payment orders would say. These payment orders under Article 4A couldn't say anything different than what Griffin Trading Company told them to do. And I think one way to think
I guess I'm understanding Judge Phillips' opinion to say these payment orders are going to be very important. And so the guide is there when you go back for retrial that the trier of fact needs to see these payment orders.
And that's one of the problems with what we think is the easiest way to dispose of this case, which is waiver. By the time this case gets back down to the bankruptcy court, 3 years after the first trial, some 7+ years after the case has been filed, after the parties framed the issue as one of the defendant's knowledge, there's now this search for something that may be an oral transmission. Payment orders can be electronic, written, or orally. We did put into evidence what Bank of Montreal gave to the English liquidator, Plaintiff's Exhibit 38, when he was investigating this transaction. We know from the fax cover sheet that goes with that exhibit that Grant Thornton, his firm, asked for the documentation showing what occurred. And they gave him the electronic computer screen that shows the electronic transmissions between the banks. I would submit that is the payment order. Defendants presented nothing to suggest that there was some other document or some other communication or that the banks could have legally done something different. And I think the confusion for the courts was this intermediate lap of the funds between Bank of Montreal and Credit Lyonnais, and then from Credit Lyonnais back to Bank of Montreal. But I think it's important to understand why the funds moved between those banks to see why that was really not relevant. The reason why that money moved overnight was because Griffin Trading Company wanted to earn more interest on it. It didn't have to go to Credit Lyonnais for the money to get to Mies Pearson. Bank of Montreal was able to directly transmit it. Credit Lyonnais was not an intermediary bank. It wasn't acting as a bridge between two banks that didn't have a relationship with it. It received the funds because Griffin Trading, as part of its money management, said, before we have to pay this money over to Mies Pearson, we're going to move it over to another account where we earn a higher rate of interest. We're going to convert it into Deutschmarks over at Credit Lyonnais, presumably because we're going to get a better rate for doing so. And only after we've done all these things with our own money will we send it back, and your instruction then is to pay that next day on December 23rd. And the risk of trying to cancel, the risk of the bank doing something in that whole process to send the money over to Commerce Bank in a way that would not allow it to be able to be able to block the transfer was really on the banks. Griffin could have complained legally and would have been in a position, to not be able to prevent the stoppage of that wire transfer.
Griffin could have complained. And I'm worried about something that hasn't been mentioned so far in this appeal, which is the party's apparent willingness to accept Judge Phillips' conclusion that Article 4A applies. I should think that's the one thing we know with absolute certainty, that Article 4A does not apply to this transaction. This transaction was ordered in the United Kingdom and involves banks in France, Germany, and Canada, not a single one of which follows Article 4A of the Uniform Commercial Code. Suppose this were a wire transfer between parties in Illinois and parties in Texas using an intermediary bank in Indiana, all governed by the UCC. And the parties then agreed that it would be resolved under German law. Would the court be bound by that?
Here, the issue in the trial court was never a legal impediment to stopping the wire transfer. And that's why
Would you address my question?
Parties can select choice of law. And
the parties agree to a choice of law that transparently has nothing to do with the transaction. My question is, if you've got a transaction that you know is governed by the UCC, can the parties agree that it will be resolved under German law?
parties can agree under Article 4A to different rules or schemes for governing wire transfers. They can do that.
They can do that in a contract. I'm asking about what happens in litigation. If I understand the governing doctrine, it's that parties can agree to a law that has something to do with the transaction. So if first question in a diversity case is choice of law, after we resolve jurisdiction, parties can agree to choose a law that has something to do with the transaction, but they can't stipulate, they can't require the federal court to apply a law that has nothing to do with the transaction. So in the case I just gave you, an all-inside-the-U.S. wire transfer, a district court, no matter what the parties agreed, would not apply the law of Germany, because the law of Germany just had nothing to do with what the banks did. It would be like a wager of law, right? And people view a wager of law as not a case or controversy. This thing looks like a wager of law at the moment. The parties are staking everything on what Article 4A would have done had it applied, which it doesn't.
And, Your Honor, the reason why that occurred was because the legal ability...
I know why that occurred. It's because the parties didn't argue law to Judge Phillip. And Judge Phillip, when the parties were saying, oh, let's all argue here in a law-free zone, Judge Phillip said, okay, well, then I'm going to apply domestic law, even though I know it doesn't apply.
Actually, it's
whether that is proper is, it seems to me, an important question.
It actually occurred one step earlier in the bankruptcy court in front of Judge Black, where defendants never suggested that they could not legally stop the wire transfer. And Judge Phillip concluded, when they argued on appeal, that there should have been some different law cited by Judge Black, who cited it really in passing just for the unremarkable position that every electronic funds transfer law that's out there allows for stoppage of a wire transfer. He cites it in passing as evidenced by the fact that his opinion spends all its time talking about why they had knowledge of the wire transfer. They then on appeal say it was a choice of law error, and Judge Phillips says, well, you waived the choice of law because you didn't argue
it. Exactly the problem. But if the parties through waiver or forfeiture are essentially consenting to a choice of law that has nothing whatever to do with the case. Article 4 is the one law that can't possibly govern. We can debate whether it's Canadian or French or English or German, if they're different, right? But we're now back to my question. If the parties agree to the application of a transparently inapplicable law, should the federal court apply it?
It was the law of the forum, which is why Judge Phillips said...
The law of the forum, but so what? Right? This didn't have anything to do with the transfer, right? Your client gets on the stand and says, I'm sure the bank would have stopped the transfer. Your client may be sure that under English or Canadian or French or German law, if they're different, the bank would have stopped the transfer. That has nothing to do with American law, because your client wasn't thinking about American law.
But under choice of law principles, the court was able to assume that differences in other laws would have been pointed out and applied the forum law. And the problem that Your Honor points out all stems from...
Any reason to believe that Article 4A is identical to the law that would have governed this transaction?
Well, the most likely law would have been English law. And yes, as we pointed out in our brief on appeal in the district court, English law is like Article 4A, and you can stop a wire transfer before the other party has accepted. And so we did, there is in that brief a discussion by us in the text explaining how the law of England and the law of Article 4A are basically the same. Electronic funds transfer laws logically allow the sender of a fund to cancel under certain circumstances. And I would submit that...
I'm lost. Logically allows... Law of EFT logically allows you saying what European law should say, or is this an analysis of what it actually does say?
It was an analysis of actually what it cited. We cited the leading English treatise with regard to electronic funds transfer laws in the United Kingdom, which, like Article 4A, allows a customer who makes a wire instruction to reach out to its bank and stop it.
Under EU principles, does the law of the country where the first instruction is given govern the entire chain?
Your Honor, this happened back in 1998, and you would have looked to the law of the United Kingdom at that time. You know, you would not have looked to the European Union you know, choice of law principles that exist today. This happened over 12 years ago at this point.
As of 1998, does the law of the EU make the law of the place where the first payment order is issued controlling?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question. I'm not sure that that was developed at that time.
I don't know the answer to that question either, which is one of the things that bugs me about this case.
I would submit the answer, then, is waiver. They didn't make this the center point of their defense, and they should not have been allowed to turn this into the mess that it became. But given how it developed and how the courts applied Article 4A, the evidence was sufficient for the courts to determine that the earliest time that Mies Pearson accepted was 11:52 a.m. on December 23rd, that there's nothing that could have been stated between the debtors' banks, Griffin's banks, that could have changed that, because Mies Pearson never gave its client credit for the money, and that all Griffin had to do was tell its own banks, stop this movement of funds, we don't want to send it over, it's customer money and it shouldn't be going to Mies Pearson at this point in time. I see I'm moving into my rebuttal time. I don't know if the court has any other questions.
I've got one more question before you sit down, which is, how is it that this transfer was initiated anyway? The transfer was out of a segregated fund. The fund is supposed to be managed in such a way that all other customers' equity is protected. And one would think that the main basis of liability of the Griffins in this case was that they set up the segregated fund in a way that allowed a transfer out of it in an amount exceeding the equity of any particular customer. And of course, that theory of liability wouldn't have anything to do with whether they knew about the impending transfer or could have stopped the impending transfer. The trustee ever make such an argument?
We didn't argue it that way, no, Your Honor. We argued that they what we argued is that they acted in a grossly reckless manner on that day finding out about the transfer and stopping.
The point I'm making is that what they did on that day mattered only after they had set up the management of the fund in such a way as to jeopardize other customers' money. And you say the trustee never made anything of that, which I would think is a crystal clear basis for liability.
We did argue that their risk management procedures were defective, that they didn't do the things they were supposed to do to protect customer money. Judge Black did not rule in our favor on that. He said that they were aware of problems that they had, and that gave them a heightened awareness on that day that they needed to take control and that they didn't take control. So he didn't find liability on the general failure to follow risk management procedures appropriately, which is, I think, what Your Honor's going to. Instead, he found liability based upon what they did that day.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Poore.
May it please the Court. This case is about, in its most basic, a failure of proof. And the bankruptcy court may be affirmed for three separate reasons. First, the trustee did not carry his burden on causation. Second, the trustee did not carry his burden on damages. And third, the trustee did not prove gross negligence, that is, that the defendants were recklessly uninformed because they did not know that a wire transfer from England to Germany might someday be governed by the Illinois UCC.
No sane person would think that a wire transfer from England to Germany would someday be governed by Article 4A.
And that's,
let me ask you the question I asked Ms. Steep. How is it that the parties through, whether you call it waiver or forfeiture, can cause the application of a law that is no more applicable to this than the law of Mongolia?
And the reason that happened is the way this issue came up. Contrary to what the trustee says, this case was originally in large part tried about questions of whether the defendants were prudent in their risk management. The bankruptcy court found that there was no liability as to their supervision or risk management. It was all focused on December 22nd.
But as Ms. Steig points out, there was a lot of attention to whether they knew about this. And if the focus is on knowledge, you're not going to be looking so much at what's happening with wire transfers. And in fact, not only are these international matters that could well be relatively consistent from one country to the next. There are other systems like the CHIP system that you point out in your brief that cause a uniform pattern to develop around the world, I mean, where wire transfers are protected in some ways and they can be stopped in other ways. So I'm not sure that the shift in theory was as innocuous as you're saying it is.
Well, if I might just return to the question Judge Easterbrook was asking, well, why are we using Article 4A now? The reason is the trustee, the words Article 4A never surface in this case until the trustee's post-trial reply brief.
Right, because that's not what the case was about.
And the case really was about in that whole idea of pulling the money back. It surfaced during the trial and during the post-trial briefing. We did not file a SIR reply to that.
But they won the first time in the bankruptcy court.
That's correct.
So why would they start introducing new theories? They were perfectly happy with what the bankruptcy court said first time.
But the critical question of why 4A applies is that it's raised in a post-trial reply brief. We don't raise a SIR reply that says you cannot use Illinois UCC law to govern a transfer between.
Right, but what was the context? I mean, why was anybody even starting to worry about that in the post-trial?
The reason for that, Your Honor, is that in our response to their brief, they're saying you knew about it, and we said we didn't know about it, and we also said even if we knew about it, there's no evidence that it could have been called back. In response to that, they said, as a matter of law, under Article 4A, you could have pulled it back. That's in their reply. We did not file a SIR reply. We then go up on appeal to Judge Phillip. Our first argument before Judge Phillip is, Article 4 can't possibly apply because the choice of law section says, in Section 507, that you would apply the law where the banks are located. Obviously, there's no Illinois bank involved in this case. The trustee argued, well, you waived it because you, essentially didn't file a SIR reply. And Judge Phillip agreed with them on that and said, you're foreclosed on that issue. We're going to now shift the case. It's going to be an Article 4 case. We still maintain, that was error to move down that path because not filing a SIR reply is no kind of waiver here. The fact that we did not raise the issue in a SIR reply did not mean it was waived. So that's how Article 4A, in this roundabout way, gets to be the focus of much of this case. As I mentioned, the whole idea of this being waived really makes very little sense at all. We did raise before Judge Phillip that that even under Article 4A, there was a failure of proof.
Well, I guess I want to step back for a minute because this case has really turned into a mess, is all I can say. And I'm not quite sure what the original problem was. But it does seem that under most systems, it is possible for a customer who has initiated a wire transfer to stop it before it moves over into the hands of a stranger, I'll just say, a stranger bank, the ultimate beneficiary. And here there is a period of some 13 hours, according to the timeline that I'm looking at, between the time that the money is transferred from Griffin's account at London Clearing House to Bank of Montreal, and then it's literally the next day, December 23rd. So from 11:19 in the morning to 11:51 in the morning the next day. So I don't quite see why at some point when this is all still in accounts held by Griffin, under any law that I'm aware of, it wouldn't have been possible for somebody operating under a rational system, whether it's the UK, whether it's the German system. I mean, I've spent a lot of time looking at European commercial law, and it's really not some kind of weird outlier law. I mean, they're very sophisticated banks in London, and they operate under ordinary rules. Why somebody couldn't have stopped it. And so I just don't see where, you know, where the contrary can be proven, especially if you're looking for non-existent written records of oral orders.
Well, the key here, I would first start, is that you have to know what the rules are in terms of how you pull it back. And under the CHIP system, as we point out in our brief, once the wire transfer is gone, you can't pull it back.
But when did this wire transfer go? The money goes from London Clearing House to Griffin's own account at Bank of Montreal. That's not the same thing as a wire transfer to Commerzbank. There's going to be a whole different CHIPS number. I mean, there's going to be everything is going to be different. So I don't even know when the money goes.
Well,
so when you say that, it's not too helpful to me.
But in this case, and that's really the failure of proof here, is because Article 4A, if that's the law, and you know, for all the reasons we've talked about already, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to apply Article 4A. But
the money doesn't leave Griffin accounts until sometime on December 23rd.
But the critical piece here, and this is what the bankruptcy judge and Judge Castillo focused on, and Judge Phillip as well, is that merely because it's en route through a company account doesn't answer the question of whether those banks had sent a payment order. Once they send a payment order, that is an instruction. In this case, it would have been an instruction on, we don't know what time, and that's really the problem, on the afternoon of the 22nd, pay Commerzbank the next morning.
At some point, you're asking for a negative here. They have from Commerzbank when they get the money. And so you're saying, well, hypothetically, there could have been something back in September of 1998 saying we're going to give you this money on December 23rd.
There could have been
something any time in the world.
That's correct. But what we do know is that...
But how do they prove that there wasn't something?
What they would need to prove, and this is what the bankruptcy court and Judge Castillo and Judge Phillip focused on, they'd have to provide evidence of a payment order which says at, say, 2 o'clock on the 22nd, we're sending this money down the line.
But what if there is no payment order? What if all there is the 11:51 a.m. transfer from Credit Lyonnais to Bank of Montreal and the 11:52 a.m. transfer to Commerzbank?
Well, there.
What proof? Suppose you're them. You know, what evidence do you put in the record to show the absence of something earlier than 11:51 a.m.?
Well, you'd look for whatever. You would have evidence from the people who were running the operations at Commerzbank.
So you go get under the Hague Evidence Convention a deposition from somebody at Commerzbank, assuming the Germans let you do that.
Or you'd have to start with the London Clearing House, Bank of Montreal, Credit Lyonnais.
So you'd have to have like oral testimony from all these people saying, I don't remember a piece of paper.
Or in this
because
case...
you're trying to prove the non-existence of the piece of paper.
Well,
that's your task.
Well, the other piece, too, this could well have existed in terms of a telex or
you're
a fax.
You're still trying to prove the existence of it. I'm asking you to turn your head around and say, what kind of evidence do you think would be adequate to prove that there was no earlier order?
Well, you'd have
if you say it's impossible, then that's fairly unsatisfactory.
Well, I would say that it's you would have to talk to the people who ran the wire transfer room at Bank of Montreal, Credit Lyonnais, say, what was your procedure in December 1998? Did you use written wire transfer instructions? If so, what did they look like? Do you have records of those written wire transfer instructions? Or did you send these along verbally on the phone? Did you use a telex? What was your procedure in December 1998? And I think that's how you would find out. Just, you know, whether it was...
And they say the world was crashing to our feet that day, and so we were just on the phone all day.
Well, I mean, our clients have said that it was a huge crisis that day. And
right, and I'm
and
just
so
saying that day of all days, you know, maybe it
right.
was phone calls. And
but I'm saying...
there would be no record.
And I'm saying as far as Your Honor's question, I take that to mean you talking to the banks. I mean, this was just another wire transfer for a bank on December 22nd, 1998. And you would go back to the bank's operations people and say, okay, tell us how you did it back then. And they would say, well, our standard practice was we sent out written wire transfer instructions, and this is what we would have done, and that's how you would ferret this out.
That might be their testimony. I have to say, my confidence in the banking industry in recent years has been shaken, and I wonder if perhaps oral orders did exist.
We don't know. That's part of the...
They certainly do in the United States. We don't know if they do in Canada or the UK.
But we do. Here's the thing we do know. Exhibit 38, and this is something that Judge Castillo focused on in footnote 11 of his opinion, because at the... In the trustee's opening brief, they say that these payment orders are, quote, unnecessary. In the reply brief, they point to an Exhibit 38, which they claim is the an example of a payment order. This is Exhibit 38. Judge Castillo, in his opinion, at footnote 11, says this could not possibly be a payment order. It just shows the movement of funds, and it also recites that handwritten received instructions at 22/12, which would have been December 22nd, so that there's at least some kind of inference that instructions of some sort were going on the 22nd. And so that's as good as it gets in this case, and Judge Castillo's point, as it was for the bankruptcy judge, that's speculation. We don't know when on the afternoon of the 22nd any of this was happening.
Part of this comes back to my question. Is Judge Black and then Judge Castillo were looking for something that would be recognized as a, quote, payment order under Article 4A. But what if, in the banking system that was actually being used at the time, something that looks like a payment order under Article 4A just is not part of the transaction? Well, then the trustee can't produce it because it didn't exist, right? The kind of instructions that might have been used in the United Kingdom or the European Union at the time just don't match Article 4A. But then it's a complete mess. It shows even more clearly, one would think, why we shouldn't be applying Article 4A.
I agree, Your Honor. We should not be applying 4A. And that was our first point on our appeal to Judge Phillip, that it cannot, 4A cannot possibly apply under 507 of the code. That the choice of law says it can't apply.
So why shouldn't we just send this case back and get it done over again this many years later?
Well, I think
properly?
it's a failure because the trustee has had his chance twice, two trials already. And, Your Honor,
trustee won in the first trial, so I can't really blame the trustee for being happy to let that one stay.
But the reason is that it still comes down to a failure of proof in terms of if it cannot be 4A, then it was the trustee's burden, as we said. If the trustee's going to raise Article 4A in a reply brief, that wasn't correct.
It was kind of a for instance, I think, at that point.
Well, the Judge Black, in his oral ruling, said, I think you knew about it, and it could have been pulled back as a matter of law under 4A. Now, I mean, that was our first point on appeal to Judge Phillip, was 4A doesn't apply. And the legal framework, that's part of the trustee's burden in terms of causation. How do you prove that it could have been pulled back? Part of that burden was to give some kind of legal framework. The burden was not on the defendants in this case to try to disprove something like that. That was part of the trustee's burden. And in this case, there's simply no attempt by the trustee to give that framework except in the 11th hour in a reply brief, and that's too late. There's also two additional reasons to affirm the bankruptcy court here, and that is the trustee's failure to prove damages. The CFTC's own rule that the bankruptcy court applied, and we maintain that it was not a violation of the mandate rule for the bankruptcy court to apply the correct law. And the CFTC's rule for segregating funds on foreign exchanges is narrower than the one on domestic exchanges, and it says that you look to what is actually being traded at the time, And here, whether there was a depletion of those foreign exchange and foreign secured funds required evidence of what the status of the company's customers were, the individual customers were, on the morning of December 22nd when the funds moved out of the London clearinghouse. The trustee never presented any evidence as to whether those funds were depleted by this transfer. What he showed was a report at the end of the day showing that after all of Park's losses, there were insufficient funds. That did not show, as the bankruptcy court found, that there was a depletion of this amount. Also, critically, the trustee never proved what was in Park's account on that morning, which was over $1.5 million, and whether that money was part of the transfer. Simply because Park had undiscovered losses doesn't mean his account was zero. So we have no idea of whether Park's money was part of this transfer. Without any evidence of the individual accounts on the morning of the 22nd, including Park's account, it's speculation as to whether these funds were depleted. And so the bankruptcy court correctly found there was a failure of proof on damages as well. And finally, for the third reason to affirm, the fiduciary duty claim here requires proof of gross negligence and self-dealing. And the defendant's actions on the 22nd were a far cry from that. Gross negligence has a particular meaning under Delaware law. It requires proof that an officer directed acted in a way that was recklessly uninformed. And I would submit that the not knowing that the Illinois UCC might apply.
Thank you, counsel.
Is not recklessly uninformed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything further, Ms. Steed?
Yes, Your Honor. First, we would point out that waiver was not argued simply because they didn't file a SIR reply. We argued waiver because they never argued that there was a legal impediment to stopping the wire transfer. They never developed that argument during the first trial. They testified that they could and would have stopped the wire transfer. These were sophisticated individuals with very detailed knowledge of the banking system and of the commodity system. Their job, their business, was making money with money. They understood what their banks would be able to do. And having framed their defense that way, it was waiver to come in and suddenly suggest that technical banking rules prevented them from calling their bank and stopping the transfer of funds. It wasn't a question of not filing a SIR reply, as counsel says. In terms of this issue of what law applied, we did provide Judge Phillip with an English treatise which explained that, as Your Honor indicated, English law isn't really no different than the UCC. It does allow for the stoppage of a wire transfer. And the frustration that I think Judge Phillip may have had and that Judge Black certainly had when he reopened the choice of law question below was that defendants never once identified the law they wanted applied or what it said. They simply stood back and said, it's got to be some other law. It's not this law. And that's why there was error here to allow these arguments to be raised. The court should find waiver.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.